The governor doesn't dismiss recent criticism over Indiana's competitiveness. Speaker Houston Coy on a new Ways and Means chair, plus record overdose deaths again, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending June 3rd, 2022.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
Governor Eric Holcomb isn't dismissing critiques of Indiana's competitiveness despite recent economic investments in the state. A few weeks ago, Eli Lilly CEO David Ricks delivered sharp criticism over Indiana's ability to attract businesses and talent. He said the Hoosier State doesn't measure up in the education attainment of its workforce, healthcare costs, and the inclusion of underrepresented groups and immigrants. Then, last week, Lilly announced a $2 billion expansion in the state. Still, Governor Holcomb says that doesn't negate Ricks's warnings.
I think Mr. Ricks stated the obvious. The more talent, the more educated, the healthier, the more skilled up Hoosiers are, the better every company, not just Eli Lilly, but every company will do.
Holcomb emphasized that Indiana's most important asset is people and how smart and healthy they are. At the press conference announcing Lilly's new investment, Rick said the company and the state would have to work together to ensure a constant flow of highly trained workers. How should we view Dave Ricks's criticisms now? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat, Ann Delaney. Republican, Mike O'Brien. John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Lindsay Erdody, associate editor for Axios Local. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. And yes, if you were paying attention, that's a new title for Lindsay Erdody. Congratulations on your new job.
Thank you.
Mike O'Brien, we talked on this show a few weeks ago extensively about Dave Ricks' comments and criticisms. Is he talking out of both sides of his mouth?
I think he's kind of putting his money where his mouth is, in a way. The development of the workforce here isn't for the business to sit over here and look at the government and go, let us know when the workforce is trained, right? And then we'll grow.
At least it shouldn't be.
Then we'll create a job. It's very much having businesses invested in this to identify and train workers, and the state's doing a lot to assist in that. So, you know, and in part, you know, we need... We have great community leaders, but, you know, we have a generation, Jim Morris and these guys that kind of built Indianapolis and central Indiana and set big goals. We don't have a tremendous pipeline of those people to replace the guys who were here a half a century ago doing this to begin with and putting Indiana in the position that it was, and we need that too. And maybe Ricks is one of the people that can help lead the way and lead by example.
This didn't happen in a vacuum. We can assume that Dave Ricks knew about this investment he was about to announce when he was making those comments. So in that way, does that maybe more inform those criticisms even more than we thought at the time?
Well, I think when you look at what this is, okay, this is a manufacturing facility, all right? Indiana is the manufacturing state. So that part makes sense, and it's going to make 1,000 or 2,000 workers and their families very happy because they're good jobs. But for the part of Lilly that's doing research and development and that's going to states that invest in public and higher education and invest in healthcare. And Indiana's not among them. What Dave Ricks was saying is if those investments occur, that benefits everybody in Indiana. In all of us, it benefits, as opposed to a couple of thousand workers. And I'm not saying that, you know, I'm sneezing at a couple of thousand good jobs. I'm glad about that. But what's happened with manufacturing, as we've seen, is automation. And the number of people employed in that in manufacturing industries has plummeted. And we need to think about what the jobs of the future are going to be. And what Dave Ricks is saying is that if we don't spend the money on K-12 and higher education and making a healthier and more inclusive workforce, we're going to miss out on those jobs. And that is a clear message because we're not doing what we need to do.
So asking the governor the question that I asked him, which was basically what we're talking about here, does this investment from Lilly negate all of Dave Ricks's criticisms? Barely by the time I got the question out, he was like, absolutely not. No one should take that away from this. Is he right?
Well, I think he understands, like, there are some of these problems still ongoing in the state. And Ricks even clarified or, I guess, emphasized something else he said when he made those critiques in that, He also said, this is a state where people care about the future and people are going to work together to, you know, make sure that future is bright and, you know, that we solve these problems, right? Well, that being said, those problems aren't solved quickly, right? I mean, they're certainly not solved by the time that announcement was made, and they're not going to be solved, I don't know, even before they start hiring for some of these positions. And so I think the governor realizes, and you kind of saw this in his statements and in Rick's statements, that they're going to have to work together to fill these jobs, and not just the jobs for Lilly, but the jobs for the businesses that will be around Lilly. You know, Rick's talked about wanting suppliers to locate nearby. Well, those are more jobs, and you're going to need, you know, a skilled workforce to fill those positions as well.
John, I'm going to combine a little of what Mike said and a little of what Lindsay just said, which is Mike talked about this can't be businesses telling the government, oh, fix these problems. It has to be done collaboratively. And Lindsay's point that none of this is happening quickly. Is when you take the fact that Rick's made these criticisms, then announced this expansion, and the governor afterwards says, yeah, he's still right, we need to work on all these things. Does that sort of signal that we're all in this together and we all need to be moving, you know, in one direction?
I think there is an element of that. And keep in mind, when we talk about Eli Lilly, we're not talking about a disinterested party that just is offering a critique, you know, a sort of a scholastic critique of the workforce and the living climate in Indiana. They've been here since, what, Reconstruction. They're heavily invested in this community, and in fact, they derive benefit from being in Indiana, too. I believe that there are a number of poison pills that have been inserted the General Assembly over the years to give Lilly protections that it might not receive from unwanted advances from corporate suitors and others that might try to take it over. But for those types of things, Indiana's been good to Eli Lilly just as Eli Lilly has been good to Indiana. So it's not as if we have a company that's just looking at a map of the United States and saying, let's start fresh. Where do we want to go? And choosing Indiana. It's already here. It wants to dance, I think, with the one that brought it this far for a lot of reasons. And contributing to the quality of life overall is certainly a laudable one as well.
Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we post an unscientific online poll question. And this week's question is Eli Lilly CEO David Ricks's criticism of Indiana's competitiveness negated by Lilly's new $2 billion investment in the state? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question, will Indiana Republicans pitch inflation relief for Hoosiers? Just 38% of you say yes, 62% say no. I'd say that's looking more and more likely. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, the Indiana House will at some point this year have a new Ways and Means Committee chair as state agencies and other groups prepare their budget requests for next year's legislative session.
The new chair will replace Representative Tim Brown, who has led the committee since 2012. House Speaker Todd Hewson says there are a lot of conversations going on about that role, but did not give a timeline for his selection.
Obviously, as many of you know, have been around this building, I care a lot about that committee, and I have some experience with that committee, and feel like we got a good group of people that are interested in it, and I'm talking to those people, and we'll make a decision.
Before becoming Speaker of the House, Houston served as co-chair of Ways and Means after Brown was in a serious motorcycle accident. Brown is one of a handful of Republican lawmakers who announced their retirement ahead of this year's elections.
Ann Delaney, how important is it to get a successor for Brown named sooner rather than later?
I think it's pretty important, but I think it's more important that we have a successor that is reasonable. There's a whole element of the Republican supermajority that thinks that the only thing the legislature is supposed to do is stand out of the way and cut corporate taxes. We need the kind of investment that Dave Ricks was talking about. We need investment in higher education and health care, and we need somebody committed to that. And there's a whole wing of the Republican Party that doesn't think that that's their function. They're not in favor, I think, of public education in K-12, and they're certainly not in favor of expanding the opportunities for higher education. I think that's fatal to the things we were talking about, the growth of the state and the ability of the state to attract the jobs of the next generation. And we need somebody in that position that can think more like an economist and less like a doctrinaire Republican if we're going to have some success. And so it's important to get it done, but it's even more important to get it done right.
Part of this is, if you're a state agency, obviously you have a sort of baseline budget that you know you're going to be gunning for, but if you're one of the groups, you know, the governor's health commission, public health commission, that is preparing a major budget request, if you're Indiana University, who always would like a little more help from the state of Indiana, how you make that pitch to the first house when it comes to the budget is going to depend a little on who that is, and we don't really have a good sense of who that might be.
No, there's several names in the mix. I think it's important, and I think House leadership is looking at, we need that person in place from the start. Because, I mean, typically how this happens is you get past the election, you get closer to Org Day. Every other year when a new General Assembly, you're appointing new committee chairs, you're moving people. That causes kind of a domino effect. You're moving people around, particularly like Ways and Means. You're moving maybe, you know, a significant other chairman into another, a more significant role because they have experience. So all of that normally happens in November. That can't be the case in this situation because you can't roll in on December 1st as the new Ways and Means chairman, and this House and the Senate and the governor and House staff are like, here's the budget we wrote.
Yeah,
right. You know, it's not gonna work that way. So I think there's great names in the mix. I think there is we've had a lot of turnover in the legislature in the last few years. There's a recognition by leadership in the House that they've got to really start filling the pipeline of leaders because they're about to have the next cycle or two. They're going to have some senior guys start rolling off who have carried a lot of water. Greg Sterwald, Ed Soliday, Matt Lehman. These guys aren't going to be there for the next, you know, decade. So they've really got to develop young guys. Ethan Manning is a great young guy coming up who's taking a look at this. Jake Teschka up north. There's some like great young members of the General Assembly that they can develop, but they've got to start doing it like right now.
And part of the trick for Ways and Means is, there was somebody who had been groomed for this role that everybody knew when Doc is finally going to retire, this is going to be the new Ways and Means chair. That guy's now the Speaker of the House.
Maybe he'd like to resign.
And then the second guy lost.
Right. So yeah. How, like, it leaves it maybe a little more wide open. So does getting someone in place who can work with Doc Brown on, like, training him to do him or her to do that job, too?
Well, the ideal thing certainly would have been to have an heir apparent and somebody who could go through multiple sessions, who wasn't going to rise to another position of leadership and create this void or vacuum. And I think there is a lot of desire, obviously, on the part of leadership to get somebody who isn't of the ilk that Ann describes, that basically sees any budget process as being, you know, the equivalent of selling out of American ideals. We just got to squeeze government to death. You don't want that. You want somebody who can work with leadership, whether they're the old guard. I don't even think of them as the old guard. The ones who are in
the
those positions
guard.
Now.
Yeah.
And there's a lot at stake. And we have been blessed in this state. And you go back both chambers, House and Senate. We have had great people on that rudder. On the Senate side, you go back to Luke Kenley, you go back to Larry Borst on the House, you go back to Jeff Espick. I mean, there are people who know.
Pat Bauer.
Yeah. So, they knew their way around, and they knew how to get these deals done and come up with something that was both idealistic and practical, which is hard, and roll it into a package that could actually get votes and a gubernatorial signature.
When Tim Brown took over as Ways and Means chair from Jeff Espick, that was a surprise. He had never served, as far as I'm aware, on Ways and Means. He was the chair of the Public Health Committee, which, when then Speaker Brian Bosma announced him, said, we know that health spending is going to be a major part of what we do as the General Assembly for the next decade plus, so that's why I want this guy in this position. If you had to pick a subject matter to sort of pick someone for, what do you think that would be?
Oh, gosh.
That's a tough one.
Don't make me pick a subject. We just sat here and talked about how there's all these areas where the state needs to prioritize spending and really invest in to make all these improvements. And I don't know if we can pick just one. I guess if I had to pick two, it would probably be health and education, right?
Yeah, we didn't fix health care in the last decade.
Those are the two big ones.
No, we're still working on that
one.
Yeah. Just to be
but,
clear.
You know, that being said, I think whoever is in the role is not going to be someone who is, like, totally unaware of the process and what's going on. You know, they're not going to, like, set this person up to be running around like crazy not knowing what's going on.
Yeah, Todd Houston's not picking a freshman for this.
Yeah, exactly. And you do still have Todd Houston as speaker there, and he knows, you know, how to put together a budget. He's done it. He has the experience. So it's not like you're losing all of that expertise and all of that knowledge with Doc Brown.
There's not like one guy doing this.
No. You know, and it's a lot of
Jeff Thompson has written
too.
the He's written the school funding formula for years. Right. You know, he'll still do that. I mean, there's still really experienced people around. So in that sense, you could pick a younger guy if you're looking forward or making a long-term pick, because you don't like having your Ways and Means chairman serve for like a term or two and then
I want to focus on one thing. You just said a younger guy.
Yeah, he has a candidate.
Well, no. I want to ask, I mean, and this is its own maybe topic, but are there a lot of women?
Sharon Nagel's. Well, I mean, Sharon Nagel's in the mix in that. I think. Okay. I don't know if she wants to be. It's like the other thing is, you know, one thing you do kind of hear around the state house is there are candidates who have said, "Do not appoint me." That's because it does change your life as a legislator.
Yeah.
Even if you're a chairman,
you
right now,
you almost become a full time.
You become a full. You're in Indianapolis a lot of the time.
And this year is going to be even more interesting because of all the money the state has. Sure, I'm not sure if that makes it easier or harder.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has released its provisional report on overdose deaths in the U.S. last year. And as WFIU-WTIU's Mitch Legan reports, Indiana saw record numbers for the second consecutive year.
The state saw 2,700 Hoosiers die of drug overdoses last year, about 500 more than the previous record set in 2020. State drug czar Douglas Hunsinger knows the culprit.
85% of those are due to fentanyl.
Fentanyl was initially developed to treat pain from serious illnesses like cancer, but it's cheap and potent, so drug dealers mix it with other substances to provide a more powerful high. Travis Jester is the director of recovery for the Jay County Drug Prevention Coalition. He says they're seeing fentanyl in everything, mixed with cocaine and heroin, or pressed into pills to look like other drugs.
What we've seen in this area is an uptick of, you know, it's, and I apologize, I'm going to use like street terms, but say that's the white fentanyl. That stuff will kill you. Stay away from that. The brown fentanyl is acceptable, you know, and as a person in recovery, you know, when I was doing heroin, it was always brown. So as soon as I heard about white stuff, it's like, yeah, that's not heroin.
Indiana will receive $506 million this fall from drug manufacturers for their role in the opioid epidemic.
John Schwannis, there's been such a focus, understandably, of course, on the COVID-19 pandemic these last 2 years. Is it time for the larger public to start refocusing some attention on the opioid epidemic?
I think it has to, because the problem has been masked, perhaps, or obscured somewhat by COVID, again, understandably. But if anything, COVID only exacerbated a long-running problem, because the same factors that were contributing, I think, to this spike, most public health experts would say, which were, you know, economic challenges for certain segments of the state, both demographically and geographically, creating sort of a sense of hopelessness and the availability of these drugs in increased amounts, created the perfect storm. That was before COVID. You throw in COVID, where, again, we joke about how the state's flush with cash. We talk about how, you know, the markets are strong, et cetera, et cetera. But there are a lot of people who are still hurting, who took a blow during an economic blow during COVID and have not recovered. And so I think that's certainly contributing to this increased spike. And we talked about quality of life and the issues facing our state on sort of the grand scale at the top of the show. And I'd say this is a part of that equation. A drug-addled society or workforce is not an effective workforce.
I'm not going to say the General Assembly has ignored the opioid epidemic the last few years. It hasn't. They passed some bills. You could argue that help or hurt. But do you think we'll see a renewed focus on that as we go into the next session or two?
It's possible. It could certainly come up. I mean, we've talked about how health is going to be a big focus in the budget and in other legislation that comes up in the following year, the governor's public health commission. But, you know, that's looking at a lot of different health conditions, not just drug overdoses and drug usage. So we'll see. But I mean, you would think that this is starting to get a little bit more attention. I mean, we're not talking about like 1-2% increase year over year. This was, what, 20-21%? That's a big jump. And I mean, yeah, COVID took over and rightfully so. And it kind of almost feels like when you have like five fires going on, you got to pick like the biggest one to put out. And this just hasn't been the biggest one yet. But like, at what point is it?
There's public health experts largely say that trying to criminalize your way out of an opioid epidemic is not the way to do it. But we reformed our state's criminal code a decade ago, and that maybe helped some things, but it hasn't been certainly hasn't been a fix for a lot of stuff. Are we going to start seeing lawmakers try the tough on drugs, tough on crime route again?
I hope not, because the tough on drugs only exacerbates the problem. It doesn't stop the problem. It doesn't cure the problem. The problem is you have a whole segment of society that's outside the health care and outside the economic opportunity. And we need to address that in order to give them something else. And locking them up at, what is it costing now, $75,000 an inmate, it seems to me we could transfer half of that as a subsidy for them, and they'd be they'd be better off, and we wouldn't keep building prisons. I don't think the tough on crime approach is a good one. I mean, if you want to go after dealers, that's one thing, but we already do. Yeah. But on usage, it makes absolutely no sense, either morally or economically.
They just both sort of talked about the idea of there's a lot to this. There's a lot of reasons people become addicted to opioids. And is addressing this problem going to be done maybe not by addressing this narrow problem, but all of the things we've been talking about both on this show and the last several weeks about public health and access to mental health resources and adding more jobs and education? Is all of that going to, by default, improve this?
Well, we know it does. Yeah. The problems that face, one thing that needs to be recognized at the State House, and I think is to some degree, this issue, how people become addicted in rural Indiana and urban Indiana are the same. It is lack of quality education options. It's lack of economic opportunity. Or
lack of access to quality health care.
Lack of access, or you're in the system and you're in the wrong place in the system, which is what the legislature is going to try to address here with these low-level felonies that are held in local jails with no access to mental health or addiction yes. services. Move them back into DOC where they have access to those things. So there won't be a, hey, let's go make them level one felons. Let's hope.
Fingers crossed.
We know that doesn't work. I mean,
there are leaders in the General Assembly who've resisted
that's right.
that sort of thing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, the state board that oversees the Gary School District voted recently to extend its contract with an outside management company. Florida-based MGT Consulting has run the district since 2017.
The state took over Gary's schools because of severe financial problems. The manager helped improve the district's finances, but the state does not have a plan to end the takeover. Justin McAdam is chairman of the board.
We see this as the beginning of the end. We believe that as a board that we are in a position where this engagement, at least in its current form, can be concluded in 2 years. However, that does require a legislative intervention.
McAdam says the manager will focus on improving academics over the next 2 years.
Lindsay Erdody, Gary parents rallied at the State House last week about ending the state control of the district. Does this need to become a topic that's at the front of mind for lawmakers?
Probably. I mean, for something to really change, like I think they're going to have to be back there rallying again, really getting their attention, because you even heard Senator Liz Brown say that it was amazing management by this company. And so there doesn't seem to be quite yet this like big desire to hand it back over. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if there was some fear among some lawmakers that if they hand it back over, things are just going to get bad again, financially speaking. Whether or not that's a valid point, you can argue that, but I would not be surprised if that's what some lawmakers are thinking, and that would give them some hesitation. So the parents are really going to have to be saying, this is why this needs to happen.
John Shaunis, I'll give, I suppose, viewers and listeners a window into how I put this show together. I debated whether or not to do this topic because it's about Gary, but it's also about a model for when the state has to take over a district and then gives it back to that district. So in that sense, does it matter to the rest of the state how Indiana ultimately resolves its takeover of the Gary School District?
I think it should, even if it doesn't, for the very reason you mentioned. And maybe this, the notion, too, as a state, and we've talked a lot of the show about workforce development, about quality of life. Well, I hate to use the phrase that no child left behind that has such baggage attached to it, but I mean, you can't leave Gary kids behind. They're Hoosiers as much as anyone else. And so I think it is important. And I think when they go about this process, the scales have to be tipped toward local control. You could find a lot of government entities, maybe even the General Assembly itself, somebody can make an argument that a management company could be more effective than having 150 people with a diverse set of views. I'm being, again, somewhat facetious here, but there are people who would say, I could do this better with algorithms and a great team of 10 people. Forget the 150 elected officials. But we do it the other way because that's what's supposed to be done in a democracy.
Mike O'Brien, let me ask this question. In terms of the legislature, because the legislature has to be the one to end this. The governor and the administration can't do it on their own. Does it make it harder, given that every lawmaker at the State House and every who represents Gary and every community surrounding Gary are all Democrats who have very little power?
Yes, except the legislature doesn't necessarily want to be in this position. There are very specific statutory triggers that allow the state or require the state to go take this over, and it is a consistent failure of that school system over a protracted period of time. And so it is not like political in the decision that is made because, like, who cares? They're all Democrats. We're going to take it over because we don't like them.
But getting back out, there is no trigger.
Right.
That's
but
that's
just, I mean, Justin did indicate, I can't remember if it was in that video package or,
yeah, it was Justin.
But Justin did say he thinks this is the beginning of the end. Yeah. This will be the last extension.
Let's hope.
That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Lindsay Erdody of Axios Local. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.